The head of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, has appeared in public to give evidence at an inquiry into the Iraq War. Sir John Sawes said that Saddam Hussein's regime had been one of a number which Britain wanted to see changed. He said that in 2001 there were discussions about undermining Saddam Hussein, but denied that military action was being considered at that stage. The Russian Defense Ministry has confirmed that the latest test firing of a new intercontinental missile was unsuccessful. The missile has now failed at least six times. It was not a complete surprise to Western observers. Some had suggested that a failure had caused strange lights to be seen in the sky above Norway. James Rogers reports.
Strange spiral lights in the Norwegian sky baffled many who saw them. Some experienced observers suggested that this was not an unidentified flying object, but something altogether more earthly. They suspected the Russian military. Now the defense ministry in Moscow has confirmed the failure of the latest test of its new Bulavar missile. In a statement, the ministry says that the missile was fired from a submarine in the White Sea off Russia's north coast, but subsequently malfunctioned.
Urban property prices in China have risen at their fastest pace for 16 months, adding to economists' fears of a bubble in which the market becomes unsustainable. The price of housing in 70 Chinese cities rose by 5.7% in the year to November, with an even steeper rise for newly.
Good morning. You are tuned to the end of the world news from the UBC in Vancouver. This is the end of the world news.
Sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
Situation.
Shechlo. Shechlo.
Can you stop the war? Please. Just peace and law. Peace and law.
CITR has tons of friends. Because with your Friends of CITR card, you get rad discounts from local businesses. Say Commercial Drive is your home sweet hipster home. Then present your Friends card at Bone Rattle Music, Audiophile, People's Co-op Bookstore, High Life Records, and Spank Clothing. And you'll receive awesome discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
That's based on a kind of Latin rhythm known as the bossa nova. But it is not really a bossa nova, but we think that you will dig this. Because this is the bossa nova. Really a bossa nova, but we got a thing that's based on a kind of Latin rhythm known as the bossa nova. But it is not really a bossa nova. Because this is a kind of Latin rhythm. rhythm known as the bossa nova. Bossa Nova, but we think that you will dig this.
That was the Juju Orchestra from the Rough Guide to Latin Lounge. The Juju Orchestra, shout out to Eli, thanks for calling in. This is the End of the World News, and more silliness coming up. This is from a collection called Africa Plays On, all about the kind of music Africans groove to when they're playing football. Football! Goal, 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 goal! This is Alpha Blondy, great African reggae star, Alpha Blondy.
Keep it. ¡Ay! ¡Qué rico bandolero! Y dice... ¿Cómo? ¡Ay, qué rico que sí! Siendo eterno vago, deslumbrando paso a mi lado, bandolero eterno, bandolero ando. Esperando una respuesta, río abajo fluye, alma suelta, ay, más tarde que nunca. Bandolero eterno, bandolero ando. Bandolero eterno, bandolero ando. ¡Qué rico bandolero! Y dice... Observando el mundo a mi lado, me doy cuenta que estoy contigo y conmigo, sí señor. Ay, mira cómo viene ese bandolero cantando otra vez, que dice...
Novalina, here is coming Basisoko and Kenan is Canadian, this very Canadian. CITR 101.9 FM.
Basisoko.
Masila
We'll be right back.
That was a theme from Vanishing Point, which is the way the show is this morning. Thursday started 15 minutes late today, at least this show did. That's just because it's too dark outside. Everybody else out of the University of British Columbia is pondering an exam right now, but not us. We're pondering the world's greatest exam. We're going to be talking a little bit about Copenhagen and the climate change summit and what's going on in Afghanistan and basically talking trash about international events with the great Graham, who will be spinning verbal cartoons for you. How are you, Graham?
It's deadly to describe pictures on the radio. What can I say? The medium doesn't lend itself to that. However,
and the picture I see before me is indescribable, and I'm talking about only the sweater. This is pure radio. This sweater, pure radio.
It's a Christmassy kind of thing.
I coerce you, CITR listeners.
My dear mother gave me
your dear mother in 1937.
and you see it just.
Keeps on giving.
All style.
It just keeps on giving. A shout out to the great Marion, and I coerce you all to tune in on Wednesday nights at 11 o'clock, I think, and late into the evening for the Hans Klaus Misery Hour. But now, we are going to play some music which is for change, not from Africa. This is not from Africa. This is from the continent of North America. This is The Kills. The Kills. It's not from Africa, but it could be about the Democratic Republic of Congo. The Kills. I like very much this song.
Answer if you can. not the way of this. All that shouting. All that noise. All that noise. Listen. This is not the way of it. All that shouting is not the way of it. All that noise. All that noise. Listen. 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 This noise. Noise.
Phone home, if you got somebody waiting, baby. Gone home, don't wanna jeopardize your safety, maybe later. We shake the haters and get busy. You say you want to do same thing, then get with me. If not, then hit me. I know you know the history. Last ride round looking real crispy. Ride round town, top down on the grizzly. Grind all the time to stay hotter, either sizzling. I thought I told you we run stop signs. Cause we don't stop till the cops come knocking, try to block shine. Not mine, twine gun rhyme. Why? Like sunshine and cold north through summertime. Now bow down.
White beaters and jeans, always in the trap, and he looks so mean.
I need a hood boy. Go ahead, pretty. We don't
a like boy them. Take
I need a hood boy. Hot boys, hot boys, street boys, street boys, yeah. And I love them boys. Yeah.
That was, it is 2 minutes past 9 o'clock. That was Fantasia. This is the news from the BBC World Service.
Very small. President Obama has received the Nobel Peace Prize at a ceremony in Norway. In his acceptance speech, he spoke of his gratitude and humility, but said others might be more deserving. Mr. Obama also talked about the two wars currently being waged by the United States, saying that though he had an acute sense of the cost of armed conflict, he couldn't renounce it.
I face the world as it is, and cannot stand idle in the face of threats to the American people. For make no mistake, evil does exist in the world. A nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Negotiations cannot convince Al-Qaeda's leaders to lay down their arms. To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism, it is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason.
The U.S. president was awarded the prize for what the organizers described as his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy. The Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been questioned for 4 hours over the car bombings on Tuesday in Baghdad that killed 127 people. The session in the Iraqi parliament was held behind closed doors. On Wednesday, Mr. al-Maliki sacked the security chief in Baghdad in response to widespread anger over apparent security lapses. Natalia Antilava reports from Baghdad.
It couldn't have been an easy meeting. The Prime Minister was summoned to explain just how vehicles full of explosives could get through checkpoints that are supposed to protect Baghdad. Mr. Maliki, who is under a lot of pressure, left Parliament without commenting. But some MPs who attended the session said the Prime Minister spent a lot of time defending the security services. The problem, he told the legislators, was that the police and the army are still infiltrated by insurgents.
The Indian government has announced it'll split the southern state of Andhra Pradesh, creating a new state. After days of violent protests, the Home Minister said the process of forming the new state, Telangana, will begin soon. An estimated 35 million people will live in the new state, which will be made up of 10 districts in the north of Andhra Pradesh. Jubilant supporters of the move set off firecrackers and danced in the capital, Hyderabad, after hearing the decision. The head of Britain's secret intelligence service, MI6, has appeared in public to give evidence at an inquiry into the Iraq war. Sir John Sawes said that Saddam Hussein's regime had been one of a number which Britain wanted to see changed. He said that in 2001 there were discussions about what political action could be taken to undermine Saddam Hussein, but denied that military action was being considered at that stage. At the time, Sir John was an advisor to Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister. BBC News.
Oh, no, it bloody isn't. This is the UBC bloody news. This is bloody Adam and bloody Graham sitting in with gins and tonics in our hand, behaving just like the empire never ended. Yeah, bloody lovely empire. Good morning.
You're saying the empire ended?
The sun never sets on the British Empire.
Oh, good, good. For a minute there.
We just temporarily go into alcoholic stupors. And then wake up and everything carries on just as it did during the Raj.
Ah.
Yes.
I'm relieved.
I want to talk a little bit about the Commonwealth today. Commonwealth, my eye.
Commonwealth, yeah.
Yeah, how you doing this morning, Graham?
I'm doing well. And before you get started on anything.
No, don't get me started.
Serious. I have something important, and it's a sort of a public service for all involved. And you are all free to pass this along to all your friends because... it's brilliant. At this time of year, we're all worried about what the heck we're going to do about Christmas shopping. I have the perfect gift for everybody. And the
Nobel Peace Prize?
Only one a year on those. And you know, it fits the parameters. It will clearly never be re-gifted. And it will guaranteed to be used.
My seat is moist with anticipation.
Toilet paper.
I was right.
Yes, Adam, you somehow were a tad prescient. I'm a bit worried about that. You see, I mean, let's face it.
Spooky.
Everybody uses it. And clearly it would never be re-gifted. What can I say?
And you can use it afterwards. You can use it to decorate the tree.
Afterward. Before. How about before? Anyway, point being, it's a stroke of brilliance that I came up with early this morning, and I just wanted to pass it along. Do you see my brain starts working so early,
Graham,
in the morning?
Don't bother to wrap it, is all I can say.
No, that's right. It comes with its own wrap.
The only problem is it not to be opened until Christmas, and can we wait that long?
You know, you raise good questions. But not good enough.
That's what we do here at the end of the world news during right now, the important piece of political life that this planet has known is taking place right now.
In Copenhagen?
The Copenhagen summit. It's potentially now, I'm just saying, it might prove not to be. It might prove that the science was all wrong and that we really don't have to worry that much.
Where are you on the side of the one as opposed to the 1,500 scientists every day who say, well, actually we did.
The climate change deniers have been gaining ground. And let's face it.
Only in popularity, not in credibility.
What's the difference? Credibility, believability, a lot of people are questioning. And, you know, when we can't actually see these things changing because it's happening in weather time or geological time, it kind of, you know, it's really easy. You know, life seems to be good.
Yep.
So that's not a... And, you know, warm is good.
Well, I mean,
if you live around here.
We could spend the whole time just on the papers of the last 2 days on... where the brunt of climate change will be.
Well, before we do that,
I'm just saying. Yeah, there are a lot of consequences.
There are a lot of consequences. I mean, I noticed in BC, for instance, the salmon stocks in the Fraser River have declined precipitously, and that's being vaguely blamed on climate change, but nobody knows exactly the mechanism. Well, but there's still, like, super cheap salmon in our supermarkets.
Well, pink salmon.
Right.
Yeah, pink.
But
pink,
it's salmon. Right? Yes, so we don't notice, right? Because there's still salmon. And it's cheap. It's cheap. Cheap.
I mean, the discerning among us notice the difference between a sockeye and a pink.
Yeah, but it's not enough of a difference to make you give up your Hummer, is it? You see, we're still driving Hummers. Because
throw that back in
we would
face.
Rather have a Hummer than
a sockeye
salmon.
I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger. He owns five. Did you know? I think he sold a couple.
To buy the sockeye salmon, I understand.
He
had to trade in his Hummers on some fish.
Right. The two out of the last 3 years, the Fraser River has run warmer, and also they talk about the North Pacific being warmer, and so therefore all kinds of food changes happen, and... one of many things that's probably caused some of the demise of the sockeye, yes.
And yet, we still have cheap fish in our supermarkets. I guess my point is climate change isn't registering because it's not really registering.
There's
because it's this
everywhere.
Future problem. And as human beings, we seem to be superb at procrastinating. I was watching CNN briefly last night, and there was this woman on, you know, and everybody was saying, you know, but we have to do this for our children. But unfortunately, it's very difficult to do things out of concern for our children. And this woman said, well, I don't even have any children, so I just don't care. And I thought it was vaguely a joke.
Somebody
but
gave
it was
her a group hug.
It was a pretty sick joke.
Yeah, that's
because
pretty sad.
It is a bit of the modern empire attitude, which is I got mine, and it does seem to be what Copenhagen's up against is trading the short term. So I want to approach something from Gwyn Dyer on this, who's my present favorite journalist. You were going to say something, though.
Well, just a last comment on that woman's thoughts.
Why, yeah, you ought to...
They're remarkably small-minded and unimaginative. I mean, unbelievably so. And, you know, that represents a fair chunk of the populace. But
I would say by far the majority, because altruism is something that has to be developed over a long period of time. It's not something that comes naturally to us, I think. Self-interest seems to be a defining gene. And when we're dealing with billions of people and self-interest, and this is what's going on at Copenhagen right now,
Well, the Darwinians argue that altruism and group interest is Darwinian, it's very hard to discern.
It's an adaptive thing, but it doesn't mean it's everywhere. It's just another balance point.
Yeah.
Gwyn Dyer hopes that Copenhagen is a complete failure, and I think this is very interesting. This is what he has to say. Sometimes the best is the enemy of the good. Sometimes good enough is the enemy of all mankind. Jim Hansen, director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies, one of the world's leading client scientists, wants the summit in Copenhagen to fail. But for Hansen, the methodology of the treatment, the methodology of the treaty that they're trying to hammer out right now in Copenhagen is so flawed that less is better than something. The whole approach, he says, is so fundamentally wrong, it's better to reassess the situation. In diplomacy, good enough solutions predominate because we need compromise. But in this case, Hansen argues, it's better to have no deal than the wrong deal. He says this is analogous to the issue of slavery that was faced by Abraham Lincoln or Nazism faced by Churchill. It's on these kind of issues you can't compromise, he says. You can't say, well, why don't we just reduce slavery by 35%? Or let's just have 15% less Nazis. It's just not going to do. The fair and effective deal that is required at Copenhagen would take into account history, and it would look like this. This is according to NASA and Gwyn Dyer. He says that a fair deal would require the rich industrialized countries to take really deep cuts in their emissions, or rather, our emissions. 40% by 2020, say, and another 40% by 2035. The developing countries would cap the growth in their emissions at a level not much higher than where they are now, but they must be allowed to go on growing their economies, which means that they will need more energy. All that extra energy has to be clean, or else they will break through the cap. They will therefore have to get rid of their new or have to get all of their new energy from wind farms, solar arrays, or nuclear power, all of which are more expensive than cheap coal-fired power plants that are relied on now. So the question now is, who pays the difference in the cost for developing countries to create the new energy they need to grow their economies? Well, we do, the rich countries do, by technology transfers and direct subsidies. Now, this is a lopsided deal, but what makes it fair is the history behind it. And here's where I think we're in real problem with Copenhagen. Emissions in the developed countries have stabilized or declined in the whole world, except, unfortunately, for Canada. Canada continues to soar its numbers, and Canada is right now the world pariah. Embarrassingly, we've completely failed to live up to even our Kyoto promises, and we're being completely obstructive about replacing that deal.
Yeah, the Kyoto protocols, the Europeans took them very seriously. The Americans never signed on. The Canadians signed on. They were supposedly binding, but
then we had a change of government.
But in the end, there's no, but there's no political
upside.
No political fallout.
Right.
From not adhering to them.
Well, because the Liberals voted us in, and the Conservatives have been ignoring it.
I only think that's only part of it, because they both ignored it. It's not like the Chrétien Martin governments before Harper came along were doing anything.
And the truth is, I think Canada has been sitting on the tar sands for a long time thinking, when we harvest these, we'll be wealthy beyond our wildest dreams. And in the meantime, the time has run out on the tar sands and that they're no longer viable. And we've been resting our future economic wealth on the idea that we were sitting on tons and tons of fossil fuel. So it's very hard for us to give it up, because a lot of our prosperity sits in this notion that one day we'll be able to sell all of this tar sand.
And boy, does it ever get up the nose of the average Albertan, certainly the political and chattering classes, many of them.
It's impossible to get someone to see something if their livelihood depends upon not seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, sure, because there's a lot of money there. Well, in any case, even though most developed countries have stabilized their emissions, give or take Canada, they're still at a very high level. Now, here's Gwyn Dyer's point. What has made these countries rich is burning fossil fuels for the past 150 to 200 years. That is the basis of our wealth. And in so doing, we have taken up almost all the available headroom. In the early 19th century, concentration of carbon dioxide in the air was 280 parts per million. Now it's 390 parts per million.
It just seems so small, but the consequences are huge.
The consequence, yeah.
PPM, and, parts per million. That's a little tiny.
Okay. Four-fifths of the extra CO2 was put there by the ancestors of the 1 billion people who live in the developed land, the developed nations, which is a sixth of the world's population. The point of no return, after which we risk runaway warming and we can't stop it, is thought to be 2 degrees Celsius rise. And that is the equivalent of 450 parts per million. So the difference between 390 and 450 is just 60 parts per million, or a little less than, say, a seventh of what we already have now. So all we have to play with is that small distance. And on a business-as-usual basis, we're going to cover that in about 30 years, after which runaway climate change seems to be what's coming. All the economic growth of China, India, Brazil, which is 3 to 4 billion people, which is four times more than the 1 billion who've caused all this destruction so far, All of the economic growth of China, India, and Brazil has to fit into the narrow band of 60 extra parts per million that the developed countries have left over. That's why the deal has to be lopsided. But it is politically impossible to sell that deal to people in the developed countries, most of whom are willfully ignorant of that history. What we have on the table instead at Copenhagen is a sort of bastard version of a deal in which the rich countries buy the right to go on emitting large amounts of greenhouse gases by subsidizing emissions reductions in poor countries. In other words, we're trying to get the developing countries to stop making more rather than we doing so ourselves and paying them for the privilege. This is a kind of like, you know, the Catholic bishops offering papal indulgences in the Middle Ages. The bishops collect the money and the sinners get redemption. Everybody likes the deal despite the fact that it's completely absurd and doesn't do anything about sin. We all go to hell together. The Copenhagen summit is in danger of locking us into the wrong deal and leaving no political space for countries to go back and try to get it right later. Public opinion is climbing a steep learning curve, and this asymmetrical deal, which understands the responsibilities of the developed nations to clean up the mess we've made before we start telling our poor people that they have to do it for us, it's not saleable right now, but in a couple of years, it might be if there is a public information campaign. So the best outcome at Copenhagen, says Gwyn Dyer, would be a ringing declaration of principles and an agreement to get back around the table and do some hard negotiating over the next 12 to 18 months. In any case, the U.S. Congress has not mandated any reduction, and Canada is going to do its best to subvert the proceedings. So that's also the most likely outcome, that we're not going to come up with anything at Copenhagen. And Gwyn Dyer says, yeah, well, thank goodness.
Another interesting thought buried in that article was the fact that he suggests that most, you know, negotiators, whether they be hardliners or not, they really acknowledge that. That they acknowledge the fact that you know, the real deal, the effective deal, is the one that you've just described in those paragraphs by Gwyn Dyer. But as you say, political saleability is another matter.
And there's something else going on, which is just yesterday in the news. There was a leak of a document written by the Danish, which organizes the climate change summit on exactly the opposite lines. UN Copenhagen climate talks were in disarray yesterday after developing countries reacted furiously to leaked documents that show world leaders will be asked to sign an agreement that hands more power to rich countries and completely sidelines the UN's role in all future climate change negotiation, which is the opposite of what Gwyn Dyer is saying.
There are still all kinds of conspiracy theorists who say that this is just another stepping stone on the way to world government and dominance, and we're all going to be, you know, force-fed a certain amount of money and given a certain amount of food, and we're going to be controlled like the, you know, the old Soviet central government. And no kidding, there are people,
sure,
who actually believe that
stuff. Yeah.
And they think that this is the UN. They think the UN is the Antichrist.
Yeah, I would ask them, which parent are you most angry with, your mother or your father?
Yeah, I know, it all comes down to the individual, right?
Well, it really does, and our sense of grievance and our sense of being dominated in power. You know, it's like we pay so little attention to who's actually governing us that any paranoid fantasy about some greater government that is going to be evil, I say, comes from, you know, playing too many video games. Because yes, it's quite possible that that's going to happen, but if that's going to happen, it ain't going to happen because of climate change. It's going to happen because of militarization.
Speaking to your point about the fact that the Copenhagen talks have been thrown into disarray because they think they're going to sign an agreement which basically favors already developed countries.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's clearly understood that the poor countries are going to suffer more from climate change, particularly Africa. And I just want to give you a couple of really sad examples. One of the predictions is the spread of malaria up the slopes in a degree or two up the mountainous slopes, and all of a sudden mosquitoes are going to be far more prevalent, and therefore the spread of malaria will become worse and worse. The climate, not to be confused with weather. You know, there are more erratic weather patterns, including, you know, way too much rain one month and the flooding and washing away crops and then drought. And they predict in certain areas, apparently already
the food supply is going to be terribly, terribly disturbed. Yeah. And when food supply is disturbed, all of a sudden we're going to have real sort of immigration problems with people drifting from one place to another because there is no livelihood left for them.
Well, there's already been out-migration from parts of sub-Saharan Africa as the rainforest recede and as the rain patterns change only partly predictably, which means that very poor farmers have to adapt, and it's really hard to adapt from a traditional not only way of life, but sometimes to actually up and leave your ancestral lands.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes a really basic concern. And we're not talking about a few farmers. We're talking about millions and millions and millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
So you just sort of think of populations of, you know, entire Vancouver's up and moving. And
well, one
entire
of the things,
Canada's up.
One of the things that's becoming very clear is that in order to do anything proper about climate change, it's going to cost trillions and trillions of dollars. Yeah. But the other thing that is also becoming clear is that not doing anything about climate change, if in fact the projections of science are correct, is going to cost even more trillions and trillions of dollars. Yeah. And there just comes a time when the politicians have to convince the public that the time to spend these trillions of dollars is now, rather than waiting until it's somebody else's turn.
But this is where the climate skeptics or denier, climate change deniers come along and say, forget it. You know, this is unproven. Therefore, spending trillions of dollars now, you know, the precautionary principle, for example, is ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean, have you heard any quotes by that guy Einhoff, one of the Republican congressmen? The man is a scary dude.
Yeah.
This man, I don't know how this man gets around because he's got at least one of his feet in his mouth the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Well, because he speaks emotionally, and that emotional message
caters to his constituency.
Yeah, Sarah Palin has just published a letter in the Washington Post yesterday saying that basically the whole climate change summit that should be boycotted, that Obama shouldn't even be there, and that it's a great threat to the American economy, and that American prosperity has always been driven by the steady supply of abundant, affordable energy, and doesn't go any farther than that.
She says that's right, but she just doesn't acknowledge the fact that there are limits to this abundant, you know, resource materials and burning things up and all that kind of
stuff. Yeah, and her idea is that America is going to be here. We must move in a new direction. We are ripe for economic growth and energy independence if we responsibly tap the resources that God created right underfoot on American soil.
Drill, baby, drill, as yeah, both it's she that and
God put it there, therefore I can take it out. She also says
she also hunts caribou from helicopters.
We also have important, just as important, we have more desire and ability to protect the environment than any foreign nation from which we purchase energy today, which is patent bullshit.
I was just going to say, but a great steaming pile of bullshit. Yes.
Yes. Well,
spouting, you know, sort of things as though they were truth. I mean, that scares me more than anything. When you know, the idea of, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago about, you know, the Socratic principles of true
of
debate and true conversation.
Trying to understand the other point
and
of view,
possibly having to change your mind. If you can't, get to any sort of commonality when it comes to agreeing on the facts, you're in big trouble. I mean, when fact becomes a matter of opinion, and science is, you know, that for 8 years, the Bush administration basically just ignored the scientific community in the United States. They just did exactly what they wanted. And that, you know, it's legion, the various consequences of that and the various examples of that. Did you hear that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States, which is a very powerful organization, if they and they're, you know, partly politicized, obviously, but if they declare something to be, you know, against the health and welfare of its citizenry in some formal way, they can sort of circumvent the Congress and basically say, we have to do this. This is the law. And, of course, Obama sees that as on the one hand as an advantage because they have declared that this could happen. And most people think that that's probably a good thing because it will allow the more democratic process in the Senate and the Congress to work out some kind of a pollution environmental agreement as opposed to having it being dictated. It's kind of interesting. I didn't realize how much power the Environmental Protection Agency had. I mean, it was basically just castrated for 8 years.
Mm-hmm. And things are looking up. I have to say things have moved forward. And as a result of Obama moving forward, the Chinese Prime Minister, Wang Jiabao, is attending Copenhagen climate talks for the first time. Government said, and China has unveiled its own voluntary targets. Day after Obama confirmed he was going to the early stage of the conference, in fact, now he's attending the last day of the conference, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Qing Gang said that Wen Jiabao would join the gathering. China has announced that it's going to cut emissions of carbon relative to economic growth by 40 to 45% by 2020 compared to 2005 levels, which is not a big deal, but at least it is an acknowledgement and it's a step in the right direction. Meanwhile, prominent campaigners, politicians, and scientists have called for Canada to be suspended from the Commonwealth over its climate change policies.
Back to the Commonwealth.
Yeah, Canada's per capita greenhouse gas emissions are among the world's highest, and it's not going to meet the cut required under the Kyoto Protocol.
But it's cold and big up here, and we need all that energy.
Well, our emissions are 34% over our reduction target, and I would suspect the hot air we're spouting this morning ain't helping at all.
There was not even a blip. When the Chrétien government first signed on to Kyoto, it was pure lip service.
Yeah. Well, the coalition claims that Canada is contributing to droughts, floods, and sea level rises in Commonwealth countries such as Bangladesh, the Maldives, and Mozambique. And the world is pissed with us.
Think about the Commonwealth.
So
and
nice
how poor
anymore.
So many of those countries are. Sorry, I'm
yeah.
There.
You interrupt away. Yeah. Because why are you oughta?
Now another here's another. A little bit of information, which is absolutely connected with what you're saying.
Okay.
Did you know that livestock production alone in the United States accounts for 18% of global greenhouse gases?
Livestock
current
production.
United Nations figures blame livestock production for 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And this is sort of tied in with the idea that maybe we should start creating meat in a laboratory. You know, just slabs.
We are creating meat in the laboratory.
Slabs. Well, no, but they're still wandering around eating grain and pooping in the rivers of the world.
They are, but we've got meat coming in the laboratory, and apparently in 5 or 6 years, this spongy mass is going to be sausage grade.
But, yeah.
But it's going to take 5 or 6 years to make it even to the level of pig's anus in the food chain.
But I got to say, I mean, considering how packaged and how sort of, you know, cellophane wrapped and how shiny and how sort of non-gross that the meat section of any given Safeway looks, I don't think it's a big step anymore psychologically. I mean, look at the squared off slices of ham.
Oh hell!
And the you know the rounded you know loaves of beef you know that we consume. I mean, they're so far removed from what wanders around on the hoof as to be palatable within a few years. And Did you know? You know, belching accounts for a huge percentage. I mean, it's very odd.
So, in the first stomach of cows. Cut it out.
No, belching from farm animals.
I know, and farting. Yeah,
it's very
so,
crazy.
So no, you want to go farther? Farm animals?
Yeah.
Farm animals, fine. Mm. What about our pets? Somebody in The Guardian recently has done a little study of the ecological footprint, the carbon footprint of keeping a pet. Listen to this. Now, although our dog food and cat food tends to be made out of things like hydrolyzed feather meal and derivatives of vegetable origin, ash and animal derivatives. Don't you love that? Animal derivatives.
Yeah, I know. And they wonder why dogs and cats are dying earlier of cancer. You know, the things that they eat, unless you're eating unless
well,
they feed
what
them
we're
taco.
Also feeding them is horse meat, whale meat, kangaroo meat, that kind of thing. What is the environmental impact of feeding the huge quantity of companion animals around the world? Well, a book with the provocative title Time to Eat the Dog... The Real Guide to Sustainable Living, it says, if we are going to examine the impacts of all of our lifestyle choices, then we have to include pets in the discussion. Questioning whether it's sensible to feed lamb hot pot to our dogs, the New Scientist, in a recent editorial entitled Cute, Fluffy, and Horribly Greedy, found that some pets have a surprisingly high ecological footprint. New Scientist says it takes... 0.84 hectares of land to keep a medium-sized dog fed. Okay, 85% of a hectare of land.
And a hectare, by the way, is 100 meters by 100 meters.
Yeah, okay.
Like
yeah, good.
Football field.
Running a 4.6-liter Toyota Land Cruiser, including the energy required to construct and drive it 10,000 kilometers a year, requires less than half of that. So feeding your dog... causes a bigger footprint than owning a
paw
Toyota.
Print. I think the correct term is paw print.
Than driving a Toyota Land Cruiser 10,000K after building it. The eco footprint of a cat equates to building and driving a Volkswagen Golf. I know. Your cat is.
Speaking of golf, are we going to talk about Tiger Woods? No, I guess not.
I guess not. So in 2004, the average citizen of Vietnam had an ecological footprint of 0.75 hectares of land compared to the 0.84 that it takes for one of our puppies. An Ethiopian, it was just 0.67 hectares of land. So an Ethiopian was eating as much as your pet cat in terms of leaving an economic footprint. Can we really justify keeping pets that eat more and take up more carbon space than people?
Even my
time to
fish.
Eat the cat for Christmas dinner.
Yeah. Even my fish have a bad carbon footprint.
Puskins roasting on the open fire.
Even my fish have a bad environmental footprint, a carbon footprint. You know why? Because they eat fish meal, and fish meal comes from like, the sardines
up,
off the coast of Chile.
Yeah. It's probably ground up bluefin dolphin who are now endangered. You know, there's a big fight over the bluefin dolphin because the bluefin dolphin are on the tipping point of extinction.
The bluefin tuna?
Tuna, rather. Yeah. Bluefin tuna are on the tipping point of extinction. And there's a big argument about whether we should keep fishing them. And the basic international decision is, yeah, let's keep eating them. Nobody wants to give up their bluefin.
Well, they pretty much proved that there are so few bluefin tuna in the Mediterranean now, which has been a sustainable product for generations upon generations. But now they go up in planes. They have radar. They have sonar. They have this. They have that. They find them all,
yeah.
and the catch is smaller and smaller and smaller. Therefore, it becomes a vicious cycle because there's fewer opportunities for. The fish to reproduce, et cetera, et cetera. And now they say in the North Atlantic, it's just a disaster as well. I mean, it's the equivalent of chasing them down with rocket launchers and laser technology and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of deniers out there, and a huge percentage of the world relies upon fish, not just the big tuna, but everything. The bycatch is unbelievable, killing everything. They basically. I'm sort of irate every time I read or hear anything about the fish industry because
let's see you go red in the face now. Okay. A group of nations, including the U.S., recently announced a move to add a record number of commercial marine species to the international endangered list. So, fin by tusk, We're putting up fish along with icons such as rhinos and elephants. It's a new global emphasis on ocean conservation and a major failure by the world's fishery managers who have been charged by overseeing how we use the ocean. But with significant financial interests at stake, these new efforts are encountering a lot of resistance. Yeah, it's easier to protect a species with less commercial value, obviously. The convention has restricted trading of, you know, a few marketable species in the past, including the European eel and seahorses. Have you noticed that McDonald's isn't selling seahorses anymore? But when 175 countries convene in Doha, Qatar, they will consider a list that includes 8 shark species, 26 kinds of precious red and pink corals, bluefin tuna, and a polar bear, which is now listed as a marine animal, despite its lack of gills.
They're marine mammals, and then, of course, fishies, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Over 40 years, the population of Eastern Atlantic and Mediterranean bluefin tuna has declined 72%. Western Atlantic stock has dropped by 82%. So it ain't looking good for the fishes. No. Of course, Japan opposes the proposal to ban bluefin tuna. The World Wildlife Fund has lobbied Asian buyers to shun shark fin soup and bluefin tuna. So those of you in Vancouver with a sushi habit, you might consider skipping the tuna. And besides, the government tells us that having tuna more than, I think it's once a week, or maybe it's gone up to once every 2 weeks or once a month, is actually more mercury than your brain can handle.
Yeah, because they're large predators, and the fat, the best part, the yummy, fatty part of the tuna is where the mercury collects. And some of these bluefin tuna are worth a huge amount of money just on the slab at the Tokyo Fish Market.
Oh, like $150,000 for a fish.
Yeah.
I know.
They're big fish. They're big, fast predators, and they're still hugely coveted in many parts of the world. The other problem, you were mentioning sushi restaurants, even here in humble Vancouver.
What's so humble about Vancouver?
I want to know. No, we're not that humble.
Right now
we're
thumping
our chests.
Everybody's always saying it's the most beautiful place in the world.
Well, we're thumping our chest quite a bit about the Olympics and all that. But anyway, that having been said,
we should be calling them the Oblympics, because that's about how long they're going to last.
I like that.
I think there's a cartoon in there.
Yeah, not mine, though.
If only I were a cartoonist.
So many fish, whether it's at the fish market or the sushi restaurant, are mislabeled now, either purposely or otherwise. Mm. They do DNA testing on fish, and they find that the thing that's supposed to be this fairly abundant, you know, red snapper is actually some endangered rockfish.
Oh, really? Yeah.
The Japanese are pretty bad about catching whales and eating them, and saying they're all menke whales and all that. And then they find that they're like blue whales, which is one of the most endangered species in the world. Mm-hmm. So they do the DNA test, and they find that so many things are mislabeled. So you can't even get to the facts.
You can't trust a fisherman. Is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't say that.
I did. You know what? In Britain, they believe that the next ice age, just while we're on this, could take just weeks to settle. That's the cheery message from scientists who believe that a byproduct of climate change would be the profound disruption of the Gulf Stream. And when that last happened, some 12,000 years ago, it set off a cataclysmic plunge in temperatures all the way across Europe.
Yep.
The basic science is that cold water from the melting glaciers could flow into the Atlantic, stopping the Gulf Stream in its tracks. One researcher, Bill Patterson of the University of Saskatchewan, What does he know about water, exactly? Says that his studies of marine and lake sediment indicate that the last catastrophe could have taken as little as 2 months to plunge northern Europe into an ice age.
Yeah.
So when it happens, it might happen rather suddenly.
Yep. What happens, to just fill in a bit of the science, is this huge Gulf Stream, which controls so much of the weather everywhere in the world, but particularly keeps Western and Europe warm, and therefore lots of agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. What happens is this belt, this giant thermal belt, which comes up from the Gulf of Mexico, and it's salt water, and then the fresh water comes. But because the salt water is heavier, there's this the sort of inversion process, and the changeover, which sort of keeps it all going, gets slowed down or stopped. And therefore, all of a sudden, this giant conveyor belt of warm water going, you know, from between Iceland and Norway and all the way down Ireland and et cetera, et cetera. All of a sudden, it's not working anymore, and it gets a little colder up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the boys in Copenhagen will say, oops, it's a little chilly around here.
Oops.
That would have catastrophic changes everywhere, because it would change rain patterns. It would change everything all over the world. It would make Western Europe a hell of a lot colder too.
Yeah, and what, not to mention the warm water we enjoy floating up from way down south.
Yeah, I'm sure it would affect Canada greatly too. Yeah.
Well, this anyway. While we're on to science, here's a little bit of good science news for those of you who are interested. Fellows of the Royal Society, have been adding to human scientific knowledge for bloody years in between glasses of port. Sir Isaac Newton and Stephen Hawking, they're now all available online. Sir Isaac, online? Yes, all you need to do is http://bit.li. Well, actually, if you just Googled Royal Society. If you look at the Royal Society, there is learned discussion about the results of transfusing blood from one animal to another. Very interesting. Detailed account of an attempt to cure mental illness by giving lamb's blood to the poor sufferer. Letter from Benjamin Franklin trying to prove that lightning is not a supernatural force. Basically, the documents of scientific history have been provided free.
Brought to life.
And online. For you. So you science.
What's the website
freaks?
Again?
Royal Society. Check out the Royal Society. I won't bother with the Earl. It's just too heinously obnoxious to speak. But I want to do, there's two other things that have happened in the world that I want to touch on.
Okay.
That have nothing to do with climate change. Well, maybe they do. One is...
Everything has to do with
everything is.
Now.
One is that there has been another... Oh, God, I've got to do this story. This is my favorite story. In Germany, 62-year-old branch head of a German bank has been hailed as a hero after she confessed to transferring money from rich customers to help her poor clients. She has been dubbed Die Robin Hood Bankerin.
What else? Right?
Yeah, exactly. Die Robin Hood Bankerin, but somehow it sounds funnier in German. Yeah, she was given a 22-month suspended sentence after moving more than $11 million. In 117 transfers between 2003 and 2005, she did this over 100 times. The employee took absolutely no money for herself. She did it purely out of sympathy with people who were suffering financially, the woman's lawyer, Thomas Ohm, said. A good Samaritan was a mother courage nature, referring to a Brecht character who believed that she could do good in an evil world. The employee was accused of allowing overdrafts for customers who would not normally qualify. She then used money from richer customers to temporarily disguise the loans during the bank's monthly audit for overdrafts. The woman knew most of the clients in her small rural branch and had access to their accounts. So that's how she managed to discover that some of her richest customers, who had six-figure balances, hadn't touched their accounts in years. Meanwhile, others were drowning in debt. She says, here's a quote from her, "I can't understand it anymore. I must have helper syndrome." So as long as it's a disease, honey, you got helper syndrome. Well, how are we going to help you out with that one? She began to lend from the rich to the poor for short periods. The woman could have faced a 4-year prison sentence, but the court decided on leniency as she had confessed immediately and did not profit personally at all. The judge said, "It is difficult to find an appropriate punishment here. On the one hand, we have big losses, but on the other hand, we have here this altruistic behavior, which makes the case very different from the norm."
Ah.
So there you go for bankers. That's one up for bankers.
Well, it's better than her going off to Vegas and gambling it away, which happened in Canada.
You think about Madoff and what bankers have been doing all through the states, and the crime of the century, where billions of dollars of taxpayer money have been hoovered up by various banks and investment bankers, et cetera, et cetera. And then you read this story and you go, this is a little bit different from the bankers.
It's interesting how she looked at these accounts, which big accounts, six-figure accounts, as you say, that had been dormant for years. I mean, let's face it, those rich people clearly were not missing the funds.
Exactly.
I think she's totally justified.
Yeah, well,
I think somebody should build a statue.
Even the German judge thought she was totally justified.
Like,
this is the remarkable thing, is that she's not going down for, and I guess right now it would be a little bit unpopular to send her away while all of the Bear Stearns people and Goldman Sachs people are making out like bandits. I guess it would be a bit unfair. But so she got a suspended sentence. She's retirement age anyway. I hope it didn't come out of her pension. And I will bet you she's got a lot of friends in her home village.
Oh, I bet you she's probably making money on the lecture circuit, or not the lecture circuit, just the whatever the equivalent of the Oprah Winfrey show is in Germany.
You never know. In the meantime, Dubai.
Oh, yeah.
Doobie doobie doo.
Oh, I read about it.
In the meantime, there has been another major economic meltdown in the world that could just have an effect on the international economy just at the time that everybody's saying, oh, no, it's getting better, it's getting better. Either the inability of Dubai World, a state-owned corporation, to meet its interest payments represents a minor detail on the road to recovery, or it's the moment when investor concern about governments going bust triggers the second leg of a double-dip recession. I love this concept of the double-dip recession.
Well, when it happened 2 weeks ago, Adam, there was this momentary panic in the market. It lasted about 4 hours. There was this spike down, a reverse spike, and then everybody said, it's not so bad.
Well, it's not so bad as long as it doesn't happen again, because basically the government of Dubai has been backing up these major corporations who were building enormous things in Dubai. You know, the world's biggest building and the tallest this and the best hotel. They were building man-made islands in the shape of the world out in the bay.
I was just going to say, have you seen pictures of this? Basically, it's land reclamation on this, you know, this it basically what amounts to a desert on the sea. So, and these huge palm frond looking things, which one of them is in the shape of the world, like all the continents of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, half built now. And the Dubai government that had been backing all of this stuff, in a bit the way the Vancouver government was backing the Olympic Village, has just pulled out and say, actually, we're not guaranteeing any of these loans. And they put a six-month freeze on the repayment of the enormous debt mountain. And so Dubai, which was one of the wealthiest countries in the world before the recent economic cataclysm, has now essentially said, we're bankrupt. We have no money.
It's an emirate, isn't it?
And it was a very, very wealthy emirate.
Whatever an emirate is.
All of a sudden, it's just filled with debt.
But they have their emirate friends who are still awash in
money. They do, but what it's exposed is this, and it's The Guardian who's saying this, and they're saying, everybody's saying, don't worry, because keeping the world economy afloat requires keeping investor confidence up, and if investor confidence goes, the shell game is blown.
It's actually a huge leap of faith to have confidence in the economy.
It is a giant
shell game.
And what they're saying is that the debts that hobbled banks at the start of the credit crunch over a year ago haven't disappeared. They have, in effect, been nationalized. So the debts haven't disappeared. It's just that governments have taken them on instead of banks having to take them on. But that still leaves governments with enormous debt piles. And they're all based on things like future earnings from oil, like Canada has based our future prosperity on the idea that those tar sands are going to bring us a lot of money eventually. And this may not be true. So bad news from Dubai is unlikely to have more than a fleeting impact on the markets. But a few more Dubais, that would crack confidence owing to a mismatch between the confidence of the markets and the fragile state of the global economy. For instance, Nick Parsons, head of strategy at National Australia Bank, said, policymakers in the US, Europe, and the UK, pinning their hopes for economic recovery on an increase in bank lending, will now have even further cause for disappointment. So Dubai is a reminder that it is a long, long way yet to economic recovery and business as usual. Dave Marsh of the London and Oxford Group said, "Worldwide governments and central banks are running uphill against a mountain of debt. In many ways, it's a race against time." So we ain't out of the woods yet. And I notice gold is at an all-time high, which is an indication, like at an all-time high, which is an indication that a lot of investors don't have any confidence in anything but gold, gold, gold.
There's been a bit of a chill in the last about 5 or 6 days in the market. It hit 1220 U.S. an ounce, and now it's back to about 1120. So it's amazing how that's an 8 or 9% spike down. Just because of who knows? Because
everybody's buying it.
Yeah. No, but a spike down because people are selling.
But
over the last, I mean, if you look at the trend line over the last year, it's gone. The low was 765, and so it's, you know, it's like a 40% increase or something. It's just amazing. It's normally been a hedge against inflation for whatever reason, you know, they because it's tangible, and but now it's just a hedge against fear because there's no inflation around right now. I mean, so
Now there's one other story I wanted to do because we were talking about the Commonwealth. You got something?
Just a little one, which just a little. This is wonderful. The folks in Korea have put out a kind of pristine water. And guess where it comes from? And guess what it's called?
I don't know.
It's called DMZ water, as in demilitarized zone water. And the reason it's so pristine is because there's this huge swath of land with razor fences on either side, et cetera, all kinds of people looking at it, but not going there, between North and South Korea, which has been basically untrodden and pristine since sometime around 1953. So this water in these wells, et cetera, in the DMZ zone is like fantastically wonderful, crystalline, and beautiful water. So who says that a DMZ zone can't do some good now and then, eh?
There you go.
It's actually called DMZ water. I love it.
Good demilitarized water.
I know. The world is a crazy place. But that kind of encapsulates this entire show, the whole notion that everything is somehow connected to everything else in a really strange and crazy way.
Yeah, like gay marriage.
Is that
connected in a really strange and crazy way? I'm going to do it for you right now.
Make it happen.
Down in Buenos Aires, there has just been the wedding of the first two men to marry in all of South America. And it's caused a huge rift in a very Catholic country and a big argument. And these two campaigners have managed to get themselves married, and the president have backed them up. And there's argument all over the place about whether this should happen. Mm. In a place where homosexuals are regularly, murdered. In Argentina, the first two men to be allowed to be married in all of South America have just happened. And at the same time, in Uganda, they have just they're just putting through a new law that makes homosexuality punishable by a minimum of life imprisonment and what they call aggravated homosexuality by death. So death penalty for homosexuality. In fact, a 7-year sentence for touching someone's hand if it's believed to be a homosexual invitation, and also a 7-year sentence for anything considered to be the promotion or propagation of homosexual ideas, like offering safe sex education, et cetera, et cetera. So this is happening in Uganda. So Uganda, you might say, yes, but this is where Idi Amin comes from. Of course, they are very... But here's the interesting thing. The Commonwealth. God bless Canada and the Queen.
And Uganda is one of the Commonwealth.
Is tainted. With all the leaders of the Commonwealth have blood on their hands. The key principles of the Commonwealth: human rights, equality, non-discrimination, opportunity for all, liberty for the individual, and personal dignity are routinely violated. Homophobic persecution exists in most member states. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, also known as LGBT, LGBT Commonwealth citizens are at risk of arrest, torture, rape, imprisonment, extrajudicial murder. Commonwealth Secretary General Kamalesh Sharma has failed to speak out. He's ignored requests to condemn Uganda's new anti-homosexuality bill, which proposes the death penalty for aggravated homosexuality, serial offenders. Yeah, if you do it more than once, it's the death penalty, right? Once, life imprisonment.
Does it all
twice,
come out of fear?
Death penalty.
Does it all come out of fear, whether it's the Catholic Church or just people being fearful of I don't know, stigma? Is it really just, again, coming down to your
I blame it all on St. Paul.
Theme.
It goes back to St. Paul. Oh. It was, you know, Jesus never said anything against gay people. In fact, Jesus never said anything against sex. But along came St. Paul 300 years later with his rabid homophobia and fear of anything sexual. And we've been struggling under this ever since. You know, right now there's an exhibition in Britain or in Athens, which looks unflinchingly at classical perceptions of love and lust. And what we find out is that the ancient Greeks were never at a loss for words when it came to lust. And the exhibition that opened in Athens lays bare a practice of sex in classical times that is eye-popping. And so it's not something that's necessarily natural to human beings because, you know, they don't call it doing it Greek for nothing. Come on, Greeks. Call me up. The ancient Greeks were into it. The Romans, you know, thought nothing of having a wife but getting their jollies with young boys. In fact, it was considered, you know, the right of a wealthy man to keep a young boy as a plaything around him.
Well,
so
as
the homophobia is not something that is necessarily part of our nature, but it is certainly something that's been part of the culture. Since a little after Jesus, but we'll call it Christian times, but it doesn't seem to have anything whatsoever to do with teachings of Jesus. But yeah, it is. So Commonwealth nations, listen to this. Commonwealth nations rank among the most homophobic on earth. Same-sex relationships carrying maximum penalties of life imprisonment in Uganda, Bangladesh, Guyana, Sierra Leone, 20 years plus flogging in Malaysia, 14 years in Nigeria, Kenya, Malawi, Papua New Guinea, 12 states in Nigeria have Sharia law and the death penalty. Commonwealth leadership appears to not regard LGBT rights as human rights. Inaction is collusion. So we have all of these pressures on human rights, but when it comes to gays, we kind of turn a blind eye. The anti-homosexuality bill has been condemned by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, by the International Commission of Jurists, and the World AIDS Campaign. Homophobic and transphobic persecution in Uganda and other Commonwealth states breaches international human rights law. It's time the Commonwealth took a stand against it. So that's what it's remarkable to me.
Yeah, well, getting back to what the Commonwealth stands for, you know, human rights and dignity, clearly, you know, that looks pretty darn good on paper, but in the end, there are a lot of human rights being violated in a lot of Commonwealth countries. Just the idea of Commonwealth, you know? That if common good, commonness, it doesn't seem to hold any water anymore.
It doesn't, and neither do we, because here comes Charlie, and he's holding all the water in the world. He's going to sweeten your morning with some hot jazz from the last depression and not mention anything political at all. So I'm going to hand over the microphone to him and say this is our last show of the year, last show of the decade. Been a bitch of a decade so far. But there's a few days left.
It's been our privilege
to sort it all out.
It's been our privilege to make it go down a little sweeter for you this whole decade.
Yeah, remember Y2K?
Didn't we start in about 2001 or 2002?
Damn. Charlie, slap your disc in there and let me shut the puck up, as it were. Thanks for sharing the last 10 years with us. With a bit of luck, the next 10 years will be better. Next 3 weeks, Goulash is going to be in the chair, caffeinating your Christmas for you. We'll be back on January 7th. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for being here, Graham.
Thank you.
And go Obama, I say. Climate change, and more gay marriage.
Excellent.
Okay. Next year. Peace out.